We're on the air again. This is Radio Entrepreneurs, and we're being hosted by the law firm of Tarlow, Breed, Hart & Rogers in the Prudential Center in downtown Boston. And my co-host, also from Tarlow, Breed, Hart & Rogers, is the attorney, Mark Furman.
Hey, Jeffrey. Great to be with you.
Thank you, Mark. Nice to see you again. You look the same as ever. You don't age, Mark.
Not a compliment, but it's the same as ever. But that's okay.
You know, in my line of work, clients are always talking to me about franchises. People come to me, a lot of startups, and they go, do you think this is franchisable? And so you're probably the best guest. And if who am I talking to? I'm talking to Eric Sigman, partner at Laredo and Smith LLP. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you want to first tell us a little bit about Laredo & Smith, and then we can talk about franchising?
Yeah, sure. So we're in a firm with about 8 attorneys. We've got a practice areas in business litigation, white-collar crime, corporate compliance, and then my area, which is sort of general corporate transactional and franchise law.
And you know, franchises are something that I do hear about a lot. And, you know, I know you seem to have a background in how to buy, purchasing of a franchise. People talk to me about all the time some of the traps people need to look into. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I think the biggest trap that people fall into when they're looking to buy a franchise is that they get sort of enamored with the concept or the brand, you know, owning a Dunkin' Donuts or a Subway, but they don't look necessarily at the documents, at the business model carefully enough to see if it actually works for them. I think a big part of being a franchisee is understanding the model, the system, and then whether the system and the model fit with the person's strengths and weaknesses, and whether or not they can actually make it work for themselves. So I think the biggest one I would say is I'd call it from a legal perspective, a lack of due diligence, which is, you know, evaluating the concept, the system, and then also the strength of the brand. One of the things I tell people when they're sort of the first unit of a franchise in a particular area like New England is you're sort of the trailblazer and nobody recognizes the brand. So a large part of what you get as a franchisee is that brand and the connection that people make with it. The idea that you can go to another part of the world and get the same McDonald's hamburger or Dunkin' Donuts coffee, and people make the association. But if you don't have that association, you're sort of missing one of the biggest pieces of what you get with a franchise. So the it's sort of incumbent on one of the new franchisees to a region to develop that brand, whereas, you know, you look at a more established brand and it's, you know, it's already there for you.
You know, you mentioned that, and I'm thinking about people that I've talked to over the years, and there are a couple of things I'd like to bring up. One, I think that when people find a franchise that they like, it's like falling in love. They sort of feel like if they say something, they're going to lose the relationship, and so they're scared to say anything.
Yeah.
And then number two, the documents for franchises can be very daunting.
Yeah.
And very expensive for a lot of people. And again, if you're starting a business, they get nervous about bringing somebody in to read them, an mm-hmm. attorney. Mm-hmm. So I think those are two issues I'd like to try to cover with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And the FTC is the governing body that regulates franchise documents. And there's two main components to it. There's some ancillary documents as well, but there's an FDD, which is sort of a prospectus. So it's you can take two FDDs from two different franchises, lay them next to each other and be able to see the same information and compare and contrast. And that the FDD stands for franchise disclosure document. So it's a disclosure of all the relevant information that a franchisee could need when they're evaluating a concept. But they're daunting. Usually you get one and it's, you know, 200-400 pages long sometimes, and it contains a tremendous amount of information. So it can be overwhelming.
And overwhelming to have an attorney review them for you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And
if you don't have a lot of money and you just have enough to buy the franchise.
Yeah.
Or you're borrowing.
Yeah, and a lot of times people borrow from retirement, they borrow from friends and family, and they're sort of piecing together the funds to be able to finance it. But I believe, and it's sort of, I guess, self-serving, that the franchise attorney's review of the documents is probably one of the most important steps in the due diligence process, because I've looked at, you know, tons of these franchise disclosure documents, and I know where the bodies lie, right? And I know where to look, where to push and where not to push, because a lot of times the documents are not negotiable, or very, very, there's a very small window for negotiation with the franchisor. A lot of times they have hundreds of people lined up behind you, and if you don't want to do it their way, they move on to the next person. So it that part is really important, and I think for people to understand more what they're getting into than necessarily negotiate the document is very important. That would sort of answer your question about the documents.
Well, I'll keep jumping in on Mark. So the other part of it is, we mentioned borrowing money, friends and family.
Yep.
And I bet you a lot of these people don't create legal documents around borrowing monies with friends and family, and that too can become an issue. So long term, mm-hmm. you might have an issue with the franchise, or and you could have you could destroy a family relationship again.
Absolutely.
Because you're not, that's the other set of documents.
Yeah. Yeah, and on top of that, you also have with a retail franchise, sort of the brick and mortar traditional franchise models, a lot of food service and retail. You also have a commercial lease as well that you have to deal with. So you have that, and then you also sometimes have, you know, loan documents with, you like you said, friends or family or a bank. So there's an overwhelming amount of documentation that goes into setting one of these things up, but. You know, the thing that people don't understand sometimes is they set up an LLC or a corporation, but what they don't understand is they're likely going to have to personally guarantee the lease. They're definitely going to have to personally guarantee the loan that they take out, and then the franchise agreement. So that allows those creditors, only those creditors, to sort of pierce the corporate veil and get through that. So in the end, not only are they investing a tremendous amount of money, but they're taking on a tremendous amount of personal liability as well.
And the franchise documents are, of course, designed to protect the franchisor, not the franchisee.
Yes, only the franchisor.
and because there's very little negotiation, it's kind of, you do your due diligence, you invest money in a lawyer if you're smart, mm-hmm. maybe a financial advisor, an accountant as well, to see if the numbers make sense, the projections, hopefully it works out, right?
Well,
I'm a business litigator, so the ones I see are the ones where it doesn't work out,
right.
And the franchisee is trying to, claim fraud or unfair and deceptive acts by the franchisor.
Yeah, it's a huge issue for a franchisor if they're making sales representations about sales, about sales results, I guess, in the franchise disclosure process. You know, if they say to you, "Oh, you're going to make millions of dollars in your first year," they're not allowed to do that under the FTC regulations. So
the documents never say that.
No,
but the the sales meetings tend to talk about things like that.
And if you're a franchisee and they start making those sales representations, get them in writing.
Yes.
Have you seen a difference in the last 15 years? I guess I've heard a lot more about master franchises.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess that's better because you're dealing with less people on both sides. And I guess it's better for the franchisor because you're getting a person who's more financially viable. That's the assumption.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the documentation and the deals, have you seen any differences?
So it's essentially very similar. Most master franchisees will get the rights to develop a particular territory like New England or Massachusetts. And what their job is, in addition to usually owning their own franchise location, their job is to sell franchises for the franchisor within their territory. And what they get in exchange for the sales is usually some sort of an initial fee plus some royalty stream on top of that. So it can be lucrative if the master franchisee is particularly adept at selling these franchises. But as I said, they have to sign the franchise agreement, and then they have to sign another franchise agreement on top of that, which sets the terms of their master franchise relationship.
I mean, I worked with somebody who had a master franchise of a large national chain in another country, and this person had hundreds of stores within a full geographic region of a country, and it was kind of unbelievable because he was never competing with himself.
Right. Right, exactly. And you know, I don't want to cast a dark cloud on franchising. I mean, I'm a franchise attorney. I believe in it. And if it's the right concept, if it's the right model, and it works out like, you know, it did for your client, it can be really an excellent way to make money. It's a way for a business owner, an entrepreneur, to get a sort of a jump start on their business. They don't have to start from scratch. They get essentially what I would call almost a business in a box, where they get a brand, they get a system, they get a client base essentially right from the beginning, as opposed to, you know, starting up Eric's Donuts shop on the corner.
A little bit less of a learning curve, right. And helps avoid mistakes. I think one of the developments that I've seen in the last decade or so in the franchise area is the liability of a franchisor for acts of the franchisee, particularly in the employment area, with where they're considered joint employers or things like that.
Yeah, that's sort of a hot area of litigation for the franchise world, where, you know, there's a wage claim or some sort of a discrimination claim against the franchisee, and the franchisee attempts to access the deeper pockets of the franchisor by going through the franchisee and claiming that so they're trying to claim that the franchisor is a joint employer with the franchisee. Which is, it goes against the concept of franchising in general, which is that the franchisee is an independent, completely independent operation.
But I've had a number of those cases now where courts seem willing to not respect the, you know, keep it at the franchisee level.
And you'll see in FDDs over the past couple of years since that case law has started coming out that there a lot of franchisors are attempting to disclaim that liability and make sure that the franchisee makes it clear to their employees that the franchisor is not their employer. But
yeah. And then do they put in indemnities and things like that?
Yep, and that's one thing that regardless of whether that language is in there about the joint employer, that the franchisee will indemnify the franchisor for any liability that arises out of their operation of the franchise business. So,
I'll just add one more point because of my own experience. Again, this person I knew had hundreds of franchises in a master franchise situation for one of what I would say a top 10 franchise. Couldn't sell because he needed 70% or 80% vote of all the franchisors, the master franchisors, to sell his portion. So he had built this huge business, wanted out, and didn't realize when he got in that it would be almost impossible to get out. And now he's stuck in the franchise. He can't get out.
And that's one of the things that I always look at with a franchise agreement is how do you get out? What's your exit strategy? And I ask people that, what's your exit strategy? A lot of times the terms for these things are 10, 15, 20 years. What happens after 5 years? Is this an investment for you? Is this something you want to turn around and sell eventually? And what steps do you have to go through to sell? A lot of times there's some fairly onerous requirements in a franchise agreement about selling and transferring.
Once you get a good master franchisor, you don't want to lose them either on the other side. And so you got to read those documents going in also. So there's a lot of... It's a legal quagmire, and I think you've tried to get into some of that with us today. We appreciate it. Eric, if somebody wants to find you over at Laredo & Smith, how would they do that?
So they can obviously call me. My number is 617-443-1100. And then also my email address is sigman, S-I-G-M-A-N, @laredosmith.com. And then obviously the website, you can get all that information as well.
You know, I'd love it if one of your clients got into a legal battle and Mark was involved in the case, and then we could come back and discuss it.
There we go. Yeah.
It would be absolutely a great case to discuss with our clients. A little meat on the table.
A little meat on the table, exactly.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks again for having me. I appreciate it.
And I want to thank Mark Furman again as my co-host and also our host over at the law firm for the radio show at Tarlow, Breed, Hart & Rogers. Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome. Great to be with you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after these messages on Radio Entrepreneurs.